Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today I'm going to embark on a study of Ezekiel, starting in chapter 1, which I will entitle Ezekiel's Four Living Creatures. Let me give you some introduction to the book. First of all, a timeline is very important to understand a few key critical dates. In order to understand Ezekiel, I'm going to use a chart here that I pulled from preceptaustin.org. First of all, this chart summarizes the whole theme of the book of Ezekiel as the glory of the Lord. Also, you will know that I am the Lord. Now, getting to the timeline, the first prophecy of Ezekiel is roughly around 592 or 593, and his last prophecy is around 571, so he prophesied about 22 years. Now, you can divide the book into three sections. First of all, his prophecies before the siege of Jerusalem, which began in 588 and was concluded in 586, when the Babylonians wiped out the city of Jerusalem and the nation of Judah. So from 593 to 588, 7 years of prophesying horror and no hope. And then the second section of the book of Ezekiel consists of prophecies during the siege. The prophecies before the siege are chapters 1 through 24. During the siege, 587 to 586, we have chapters 25 through 32. Those chapters are judgments against the gloating nations, those who are gloating over the predicament of Jerusalem and Judah. In chapters 1 through 3, before that, before the siege, we see Ezekiel seeing the glory of God and receiving the call to prophesy. Chapters 4 through 24, he's prophesying judgments against Judah, just like Jeremiah did. Then, once the siege began, he quit doing that and he started prophesying against those nations who were gloating over the predicament of Judah. Then, after the siege is over, 586, between 586 and 571, roughly 15 years, he prophesies about the future of Judah, prophecies of restoration, prophecies of hope. Chapters 33 through 39 refers to restoration of Israel to the Lord. And then in chapters 40 through 48, visions of the temple, the so-called millennial temple, which I will take to be the symbol of the church in the New Covenant era, not a symbol of what's going to happen in a future millennium. So now let's look at Ezekiel's ministry. He prophesied to the people of Judah before the siege and the exiles from Jerusalem after the siege, the exiles who went to Babylon. He prophesied for about 22 years. Britannica has the years from 592 to 570. My chart here has 593 to 571, but we're not going to quibble over a year at the end of these periods. The periods are calculated differently depending on whether you take a portion of a year as a whole year or not. Ezekiel was contemporary with Jeremiah and Daniel. Daniel had prophesied for 34 years before Ezekiel and continued to do so for 6 or 7 years after Ezekiel. So Ezekiel's term of prophecy was a good bit shorter than Daniel. Ezekiel did not prophesy against Babylon when he prophesied against the enemies of the Jews in chapters 25 through 32. Not a mention of Babylon. And from this, it has been speculated that probably Ezekiel did not desire to give needless offense to the government under which he lived, namely the Babylonians. I think that's pretty smart. Now, what was the effect of Ezekiel's ministry? He improved the character of the people toward the close of the captivity. When the people returned to Jerusalem, they had generally ceased from idolatry and they had returned to the law. So he was a very important prophet as a reformer. His leading characteristic is determined energy. His name means whom God will strengthen. So he had energy from God, strength from God. This admirably adapted him for opposing the rebellious house of stubborn front and hard heart. In other words, the Jews. His energy admirably adapted him for maintaining the cause of God among his countrymen in a foreign land when the external framework of the Jewish religion had fallen to pieces. Now, Ezekiel was a priest. The priestly element predominates in his prophecies. We can see priestly influences which arose from his previous training as a priest. He delights to linger about the temple and to find in its symbolical forms, the temple's symbolical forms, the imagery for conveying his instructions. He satisfied the spiritual want felt by the people in absence of an outward temple and its sacrifices. Now we need to have some chronology in our head in order to deal with the book of Ezekiel. I've gone through all of this chronology in going through Jeremiah. I'll mention it again here. 722 BC, the northern kingdom, the northern 10 tribes, were taken into captivity by Assyria, Sargon II of Assyria. They were scattered through the ancient Near East. And then in 610 and 609, we have the Battle of Haran. This is when Necho II of Egypt joined with Assyria in order to fight Babylon. Babylon won, and at that time, Assyria ceased to exist as a state. And on the way to fight that Battle of Haran in Syria, Necho II killed Josiah, who foolishly tried to stop Necho II. That was at Megiddo, a very famous incident in the history of Israel. 609 is also an important date because, in my opinion, it begins Jeremiah's 70 years, 609 to 539, when the Persians beat Babylon. And the seven-year prophecy, I must point out, in Jeremiah, it never said that the exile would last 7 years. It said the time of Babylon would be 7 years, and that goes from 609 to 539 perfectly. I don't know why evangelical scholars like to argue over this all the time. Well, that's 609, the Battle of Haran, the death of Josiah, the end of Assyria, a very important date. And then in 605, we have the Battle of Carchemish. Carchemish is that city on the Euphrates River in Syria. Necho II, I believe, was the pharaoh of Egypt who came back up and fought at that battle to fight the Babylonians. Necho II came up to align himself with remnants of the Assyrian army. The state had already disappeared, but there were still some holdouts in the army. Egypt went up, joined themselves with Assyria, fought the Babylonians, got beat. A very famous battle at Carchemish. Babylon won that. This is when Nebuchadnezzar heard that his father had died. Nebuchadnezzar becomes emperor of Babylon. He makes a triumphal movement to Israel and takes an elite group of Israelites into exile, including Daniel the prophet in 605. No damage was done to the city, fortunately. So that's 605, the Battle of Carchemish. And then in 597, Nebuchadnezzar besieges Jerusalem after Jerusalem had attempted to revolt from Babylon. King Jehoiachin, who had taken over from Jehoiakim, who died at some time during the approach of Babylon's forces, King Jehoiachin was taken captive to Babylon. Jehoiachin ruled from 598 to 597. So 597 is the second exile to Babylon. Daniel went in 605. 597, our prophet Ezekiel went. 10,000 were taken into captivity, leaders and artisans of Jerusalem, the upper middle class, which included Ezekiel the priest. So he goes in 597. And then in 586, a very important date, Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon besieges Jerusalem after Jerusalem had tried to revolt again. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the city of Jerusalem. He burnt the temple to the ground. He killed the royal family of Zedekiah. He blinded King Zedekiah after Zedekiah saw his sons executed at Riblah, and Zedekiah was taken off blind to Babylon. Zedekiah had ruled from the exile in 597 all the way down to the third exile in 586. Nebuchadnezzar killed a lot of the population in Jerusalem, leaving a rump in Jerusalem after 586 under Governor Gedaliah, who was appointed by Babylon. Jeremiah stayed behind. He was given the opportunity to stay behind by the Babylonians, and he took it. So there's your background. All of this is going on while Ezekiel is in captivity starting in 597. Now, he started prophesying about 593. So for about 7 years, as he is in Babylon, he prophesies horror and no hope for the Jews of Judah. Of course, he wasn't in Judah, but they heard the prophecies. Messages would go back and forth. So we begin now in Ezekiel 1:1. In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day, while I was among the exiles by the Chebar River, the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. In the 30th year, the NIV footnote says, in my 30th year, which would give us the age of Ezekiel, but that's textually uncertain, I imagine. So we'll just say in the 30th year. 30th year of what? Here's some options: from the last Jubilee, 30th year from the time that the book of the law was found by Hilkiah the priest, that was during Josiah's reign. The 30th year of Nabopolassar, the father of Nebuchadnezzar. I'm not really sure what that 30th year referred to. It doesn't really matter for our chronology. We find out later that it's around 593 or 592. When we get there, I'll show you how we know that. In the fourth month, that would be Tammuz, June and July, on the fifth day, so Tammuz the fifth, while I was among the exiles by the Chebar River. Now, I've already mentioned to you there were three exiles, the first in 605 when Daniel was taken to Babylon with some elites of Jerusalem. They had been listening to Jeremiah's exhortation to surrender to the Babylonians, and they were exiles, so they were probably a little bit spiritual by then. They probably realized that Jeremiah knew what he was talking about. If so, Ezekiel even had a more spiritual audience than Jeremiah did, because Ezekiel's audience had seen two exiles, not just one. So he's prophesying after the second exile, which took place in 597. That's when he was taken away too. Now, the last group of exiles didn't come to Babylon until 586, which hasn't happened yet. So that's our context here. Tammuz the fifth, in the summertime, among the exiles. This is the exiles of 597, mostly. He's by the Chebar River. Now let's look at the map. If you'll look at the Euphrates River as it runs from southeast to northwest through Syria, right at the boundary between Syria and Iraq. In Syria, the Chebar River runs northward, a little bit northeast, from the Euphrates River all the way to the Tigris River. It connected the two rivers. So it was a fairly well-known river. Here's some information on that from ChristianAnswers.net. It has been supposed to be identical with the river Chebar, the Chebaris, or modern Chebar, basically different transliterations of the Semitic name. This river falls into the Euphrates at Circesium. To the banks of this river, some of the Israelites were removed by the Assyrians. We know that from 2 Kings 17:6. That's the 722 exile, the northern Israelites. An opinion that has much to support it is that the Chebar was the royal canal of Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest canal in Mesopotamia, which connected the Tigris with the Euphrates, in the excavation of which the Jewish captives were probably employed. That makes sense. That's why Ezekiel was there. The Jews are helping to dig a canal to connect the two great rivers. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 3 through 4. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, by the Chebar River in the land of the Babylonians. There the hand of the Lord was upon him. I looked, and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal. Now in verse 3, we see Ezekiel called the priest. That's how we know he's a priest. He's the son of Buzi. Buzi means my contempt. Some say that Buzi is Jeremiah. This is sort of a wild idea. This comes from Jewish sources. I'm not going to go through the quote I have here from the rabbi. I'm going to assume that Ezekiel is not related to Jeremiah. The hand of the Lord came upon him. That means he was having a vision. In verse 4, he looked and saw a windstorm. Of course, when you see wind and you see storm, that's a symbol of the judgment of God. And that's what a lot of his prophecies are going to be about, the judgment of God coming in 586. The windstorm came out of the north. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says that refers to Nebuchadnezzar coming from the north to attack Israel, and that could be. The Babylonians always came from the north to attack Israel. They had to. They couldn't go straight from Babylon east across the Arabian Desert. They had to go northwest up the Euphrates Valley, and then once the river bent over the top of Israel, then they would come down over the Euphrates River, coming roughly from north to south. So that makes sense. It could be that there's no particular reason why the windstorm came out of the north, but I think Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are right there. This is referring to the Babylonians coming from the north. An immense cloud, this windstorm was, with flashing lightning. Lightning, of course, symbolizes the judgments of God, I would say. And this cloud was surrounded by brilliant light. Whenever you see light, you see God, because God is light, and in him there is no darkness. Brilliant light, the center of the fire, looked like glowing metal. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 5 through 7. And in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was that of a man, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight, their feet were like those of a calf, and gleamed like burnished bronze. Now, I'm going to give you my best shot at describing what this vision was like and maybe what it symbolized, but I've read enough commentators on this and looked at so many artist conceptions of this that I know nobody agrees exactly on anything. And so I'm not going to worry about it too much. I'll give you an overall broad brush interpretation of this vision. We start in verse 5. In the fire, that's the gleaming fire that was coming showing out from the middle of the windstorm. In the fire was what looked like four living creatures. It doesn't actually say they were four living creatures. They looked like. And we need to remember, Ezekiel is seeing a vision. What a prophet sees in his head is not exactly one-on-one corresponding with what's in heaven. We need to remember that. A lot of times the visions are symbolic. Now, I am going to give you a quick review of the four living creatures before I get into too much details. First of all, I've got a picture. An artist's conception of the four living creatures is the one that I pictured in my mind, as closest to what I pictured in my mind. And so I'm going to refer to it, remembering that these artist conceptions are all over the place. If you do an image search on Google, it's incredible what comes up. Now, Ezekiel does not call these four living creatures cherubim, but he describes cherubim in Ezekiel 10:3-14, and the descriptions are very similar in the two chapters, Ezekiel 1 and Ezekiel 10. So many people think that the descriptions in chapter 1 and chapter 10 are two descriptions of the same thing. And since I like simplicity, I will just assume that. Now, what do the four living creatures symbolize? John Calvin says they symbolize all aspects of nature obeying God's word. John Gill says they were four men who were ministers of the gospel. Another option is they were four world monarchies represented by the four beasts in Daniel 7:1-28. Babylonia was the lion, Persia was the bear, Greece was the leopard, and Rome was the beast with 10 horns. And of course, the church fathers said that the four living creatures were the four gospels. Matthew's the lion, Mark is the ox, Luke is the man, and John is the eagle. We'll see later on that there were four faces on these four living creatures, lion, ox, man, and eagle. I don't think that any of these interpretations make a bit of sense to me. They're so speculative. I'll tell you what I think they represent in just a minute when we get there. Now, if these four living creatures were cherubim, we need to point out that there were only two cherubim in the Holy of Holies. One of my commentators says that the reason that there are four here is to show that while the law is retained as the basis of life, a new form is needed to be added to impart new life. Again, lots of airy speculation. Well, why are there four living creatures here? Well, it could refer to the earth or the whole expanse of the earth. Four corners of the earth, four winds of the earth, four directions of the earth, four rivers in Eden that water the whole earth. Actually, I think that makes a lot of sense. Adam Clark says that this fourness of the living creatures shows that God's angels can execute his commands anywhere, anywhere on the earth. Now, there are various descriptions of cherubim in the scriptures, and they are somewhat different than this description here in Ezekiel 1. The Mosaic cherubim were similar, but the Mosaic cherubim had the human faces looking toward each other across the top of the ark, across the top of the mercy seat. It's a minor difference. And then in Isaiah 6:2, the famous vision that Isaiah had, the seraphim stood above him, each having six wings. We will see that it looks like the cherubim in Ezekiel 1 only had four wings, although that's arguable. Some people say they had six. Now, we see that there are many similarities with these four living creatures with other visions of living creatures. For example, in Revelation 4:6-8, we read this. Something like a sea of glass, similar to crystal, was also before the throne. Four living creatures, covered with eyes in front and in back, were in the middle and around the throne. The first living creature was like a lion. The second living creature was like a calf. The third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. Same animals in a different order than Ezekiel 1. Each of the four living creatures had six wings. Ezekiel 1 arguably only had four. They were covered with eyes round and inside. Ezekiel's eyes were on the wheels. And the four living creatures didn't have wheels in Revelation, so it's similar but different. Day and night they never stop saying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God the Almighty, who was, who is, and who is coming." If we look at the vision of the heavenly creatures in Isaiah 6:1-3, we read this. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a high and lofty throne, and his robe filled the temple. Seraphim were standing above him. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. His glory fills the whole earth. So you see Isaiah 6 has four living creatures that are very similar to the four living creatures in Revelation 4, and they're similar to the four living creatures in Isaiah 1. Now, what I say about this, I think that they're close enough. You got different prophets. They might emphasize different things. Again, their visions, the idea is the same. So if we summarize, and if we take all the descriptions of the living beings as referring to one thing, all the descriptions scattered throughout the scripture, we see what the purpose of these living creatures are. And this is from gotquestions.org. Their primary purpose was to worship God. And secondarily, their purpose was to be involved in some way in God's divine justice, to worship and to wreak justice. I think that's reasonable. Now let's go into some details. First of all, in verse 5, in appearance their form was that of a man. Now, the general likeness was the human form, but there were some things that didn't look like a man, which we'll talk about in a minute. But because they represented men, this shows, according to one of my commentators, that they were humane, tender, kind, and pitiful, knowing and understanding and acting like men. Well, that's men as they were created, not men as we have to put up with today. Each of the figures had four faces, and the face of each figure was facing Ezekiel, was a man. So the other three faces, the lion, the ox, and the eagle, were facing in different directions, in three different directions. Now in verse 6, these living creatures were each said to have four wings. Now my artist conception has each of the four living creatures in a horizontal line facing the viewer, in other words, facing Ezekiel, and each one had the face of a man looking at us, and each one had two wings that were uplifted that would help them fly, and then two wings that were covering the lower part of their body from their chest down to their feet. Their feet are peeking out, and then below the feet are four wheels, which we'll talk about in a minute. Now, that artist assumes that there are only four wings. However, if we go down to verse 23 in chapter 1 of Ezekiel, we read this, and under the expanse their wings extended one toward another. Each of them also had two wings covering their bodies. Well, if you take that also as meaning in addition to the four wings that were already mentioned, then you end up with six. And John Gill and Adam Clark both believe that, and I think that's reasonable. At least it would make the visions all match up as far as the wings in Isaiah and in the book of Revelation. Now in verse 7, each of the living creatures had straight legs. Their legs were straight. They didn't need to bend because these living creatures never walked. They glided, as we'll see in a minute when we look at the wheels. They glided rather than walked, and so the legs were straight. John Gill squeezes some imagery out of straight. He says that the straight legs provided straight paths for their feet and walked uprightly. According to the truth of the gospel, the legs did not go into crooked paths or turn to the right hand or the left. That's very imaginative. I don't think that's what Ezekiel meant when he said straight. I think they were just straight. Their feet were like those of a calf. Now, what's the point of comparison here? Jameson Fawcett Brown says that the solid firmness of the round foot of a calf seems to be the point of comparison. John Gill says that the feet of a calf were fit for treading out the corn in which oxen were employed. This denotes the firmness and constancy of ministers in their work. Well, I'm not big on poetry and imagery. That seemed like a stretch to me. But at any rate, the feet were like those of a calf, and they gleamed like burnished bronze. Burnished means polished. The gleaming might indicate God's purity. God is always something that shines bright. These four living creatures are already in the middle of a cloud. And there's a fire in the middle of the cloud, so they're already glowing already like fire. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 8 through 9. Under their wings, under the four living creatures' wings, on their four sides, they had the hands of a man. All four of them had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. Each one went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. Now, in verse 8, Ezekiel says, under their wings, on their four sides. That doesn't mean that each individual creature's four sides had wings. so that he would have a total of 16 wings. This four sides is referring to all the sides of the four creatures collectively. In other words, you take all the four creatures, you look at them, and you look at each of their sides, and they had wings. So again, let's picture four living creatures lined up in a horizontal line looking straight at us. We can pretend we're Ezekiel. We see four faces looking at us. We see two wings outstretched to the left and right of each of the living creatures. So we're looking at eight wings, six of which touched one another because the wings on the outer two living creatures touch nothing. And of course, these wings would be uplifted into the sky, touching at their tips. Now in verse 9, each one of these living creatures went straight ahead. They did not turn as they moved. So if the four living creatures are coming at us, they're coming straight. They don't rotate, they don't twist, they don't turn. Or if they're going left, they all go left. If they all go right, they all go right. They all move in unison. They had no occasion to turn themselves round when changing the direction because there was a face in each direction. They had a face looking to each of the four quarters of heaven. They made no mistakes, and their work needed not to be gone over again, as one of the commentators says. So they move in four directions in a straight method without turning. Another commentator says they moved not by active energy merely, but also by knowledge, which was expressed by their faces. Divine guidance was expressed by their wings. Well, I don't know about that, but we get the idea. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verse 10. Their faces looked like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, and on the right side, each had the face of a lion, and on the left, the face of an ox. Each also had the face of an eagle, and that would be looking backwards. Again, we assume these four living creatures are staring at us straight forward. Now, of course, there must be some symbolism here. Faces of a man, lion, ox, and eagle. As Adam Clark says, those faces had their symbolism, could we but find it out. In other words, he punts, he doesn't know what it symbolizes. Now, these faces are the same faces as the four living creatures in Revelation. They are in a different order. We can just summarize the symbolism as this. Angelic ministers of God are intelligent. That's the man's face. They are strong. That's the lion's face. They have endurance. That's the ox's face. And they're swift and far-sighted. That's the eagle's face. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verse 11. Such were their faces. Their wings were spread out upward. Each had two wings, one touching the wing of another creature on either side, and two wings covering its body. And as I said earlier, I think the outstretched wings touched at the tips because they're spread out upward, verse 11 says. Now in verse 11, Ezekiel said, such were their faces. I'm assuming he's referring to the preceding verse. Such were their faces. In other words, there's a lion, an ox, an eagle, and a man. You could take the such as referring to what comes afterwards. Their wings were spread out upward, and such were their faces. So the faces were spread out upward, or their faces were looking upward. I don't think so. Now, verse 11 says, each had two wings. These two wings would be the wings that were the flying wings, the two that are stretched upward into the air. They are the ones that touched the neighboring wings. Now, if indeed Gill and Clark are right that these four living creatures had six wings, then we would have each creature having two wings covering his chest, and then each creature having two wings covering his private parts, I suppose, the lower part of his body. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 12 through 14. Each one went straight ahead. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, without turning as they went. The appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire or like torches. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. It was bright, and lightning flashed out of it. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. So in verse 12, each one went straight ahead. So if you imagine square-type motions, perpendicular motions, up, backwards, left, right, in whichever direction the particular face was facing, the creatures would not turn. They would just move in the direction of a particular face. In verse 12, each one went straight ahead. That's repeated from verse 9, where it is also told us that each one went straight ahead. Trying to make an application out of this, one of my commentators says that we men are so hard to be brought to acknowledge the wisdom of God's doings. They seem torturous and confused to us, but they are all tending steadily to one aim, that straight movement. Now verse 12 says, wherever the spirit would go, the creatures would go. That spirit is ruach, of course. That could be wind, but I don't think it's wind here. It's talking about spirit. But now the question is whose spirit is it? Is it a little S spirit, the spirit of the living creature? Or is it the Holy Spirit, capital S, the Spirit of God, telling the angels where to go? Most of my translations have it as a lowercase s, and so they take it that the creatures go in the direction that they decide to go. However, the Holman Christian Study Bible and the Darby translation have the Spirit capitalized. So wherever the Holy Spirit would tell the angels to go or the creatures to go, they would go. The problem I have with that is how can Ezekiel see the Spirit of God? Of course, on the other hand, how could Ezekiel see the spirit of the living creatures? So, I don't know whose spirit it was, but if it was the living creature spirit, we can assume that they were being directed by their boss, Yahweh. Ezekiel, of course, couldn't see the spirit doing this. He just assumed when he saw the living creatures, he just assumed that their spirit was telling them where to go. Or he assumed that the Holy Spirit was telling them where to go. In verse 13, the appearance of the living creatures was like burning coals of fire. So they're either glowing or burning. Fire moved back and forth among the creatures. That word fire is often translated as lightning. I think that makes more sense. Lightning moving back and forth among the creatures. The fire or the lightning was bright. Lightning flashed out of it. All right, so we can picture lightning flashing all amongst these four living creatures. And of course, they're in the middle of a burning glow, surrounded by a storm cloud, as we saw at the first of the chapter. The creatures sped back and forth like flashes of lightning. They weren't just standing there looking at Ezekiel. They were moving left, right, front, backwards, fast like flashes of lightning. Lightning means judgment. It means purification. It means enlightenment. Lightning is quick, penetrating, enlightening, efficacious. And since the creatures were moving back and forth, that shows that they did their work with great readiness and swiftness. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 15 through 18. As I looked at the living creatures, I saw a wheel on the ground beside each creature with its four faces. This was the appearance and structure of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite, and all four looked alike. Each appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel. As they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Their rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. Now let me try to give you a conception of what we're looking at here. We've basically got eight wheels. Under each living creature, you've got two wheels. They're at right angles to each other. They're transverse to each other. One wheel runs through the middle of the other wheel. That way, the four living creatures can go front or back, left or right, by following the direction of the associated wheel. Again, this enhances the image of quickness. The creatures are moving fast in all four directions, and they're following the wheels. They don't have to turn. They don't have to take time to turn. The wheels never need to turn. The faces don't need to turn. Now, here's some options as to what the angels symbolize. Now, here we're going to see a lot of speculation. People have said they're angels. The visible world, John Gill says that's the most common interpretation, and all things in the visible world, which are movable and uncertain. I don't see that at all. Here's another good one. They refer to the 24 elders in Revelation chapter 4. Now, this is absurd in my opinion, but in Revelation 4:4, we see a throne surrounded by four living creatures, surrounded by 24 elders sitting on thrones. Here in Ezekiel 1, we see a throne. We haven't got there yet, but there's a throne above here, above the four living creatures. And then we've got the four living creatures. And so to keep up the parallel, the things that are next to the four living creatures are the wheels. In Revelation, the things that were next to the four living creatures were the 24 elders. Therefore, the wheels are supposed to be the 24 elders in Revelation chapter 4. And I think that's utter nonsense. I think that the reason that the wheels are there is to show how fast the angels of God do their job, which is to praise God and to pass out judgment. And since Ezekiel is going to be talking about judgment here very shortly, he's talking about how fast God's angels do their work and how pervasively they do it in all four corners of the world. Quickly and expansively they do their work of judgment. I think that's the main point of the round wheel. Some people say round is perfection, and so they do their work perfectly too. Well, okay. Maybe, I don't know. But we go now to verse 16 to look at the structure of the wheels, the appearance of the wheels. They sparkled like chrysolite. Chrysolite is a semi-precious stone. It has a sea-green color. Sometimes it's called topaz or beryl. Chrysolite was brought in from Tarshish, which was probably on the coast of Spain. near the Mediterranean Sea. At the end of verse 16, we see that each wheel appeared to be made like a wheel intersecting a wheel, and that's where I get the wheels at right angles to each other. If you look at the author's conception or the artist's conception of the wheels on the Google image search that I did, almost all of them had this. Now, they might not be intersecting at right angles, but it must be intersecting at right angles to handle the four directions, which is a big theme here in chapter 1. So I think that's not too controversial. Verse 17, as they moved, they would go in any one of the four directions the creatures faced. The wheels did not turn about as the creatures went. Now, that phrase turn about is a little bit ambiguous. Here's a couple of options. It could mean that there was no motoring motion as the cherubim moved. I think that makes sense because if you got intersecting wheels and one of those wheels is turning, it's intersecting another wheel at right angles to it, and how is that going to work? Now, of course, this is a vision. It could have worked in the vision. That's one option, but another option is that the wheels didn't turn around. They didn't go backwards until the cherubim reached the end of his course. In other words, the wheels went straight in a northern direction, and they didn't turn left or right until the living creature stopped. And then, when the living creature went, say, to the east, the wheel didn't turn as the cherubim moved to the east. There was no turning of the wheels, in other words. No turning left or right. Or it could mean the wheel did not turn in a rotary fashion. The wheel did not go round and round and round. I'm not sure what it means. Most of the commentators think it means that the wheel didn't turn left or right. They were turning, but they were turning in a straight motion and didn't turn from that straight forward path. As John Calvin put it, they went forward to their object without intermission. This would show decisiveness and purposefulness. Whereas if you're saying that the wheels didn't turn around, I don't know what that shows. So we'll go with Calvin's view. The wheels did not turn left or right. They did not turn about as the creatures went, but the wheels went straight forward to carry out their purpose. Verse 18, the wheels' rims were high and awesome, and all four rims were full of eyes all around. Now the rims of the wheel, I'm going to assume, is just the outer circumference of the wheel. They were full of eyes. Here's some options as to what that looked like. Adam Clark says that these eyes were nails holding the spokes to the outer wheel. In other words, eyes would be taken figuratively. The wheels would have spokes, and they would go up to the circumference, to the outer rim, the outer wheel, and then there would be a nail there to hold the spoke in, as the nail would be driven out of the flat side of the rim into the spoke. I don't think so. Another suggestion by Clark is that the eyes were nails holding the iron band on the outer flat surface of the wheel. So instead of the nails facing us, they would be on top of the wheel. Instead of on the sidewall, they'd be on the top. If it was a rubber tire, it'd be where the treads are. And you got nails all around the wheel that way. I don't think so. I think they were just eyes on the sidewall of the wheel where everybody could see them. What do they symbolize? Jameson Fawcett Brown say they symbolize the plenitude of intelligent life. In other words, nothing is done by blind impulse when God has something to do with it. In other words, God is all-seeing. He's omniscient. I think that's easy symbolism, actually. We go now to verses 19 through 24 of Ezekiel 1. Ezekiel continues, when the living creatures moved, the wheels beside them moved, and when the living creatures rose from the ground, the wheels also rose. Wherever the spirit would go, they would go, and the wheels would rise along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. When the creatures moved, they also moved, the wheels would move. When the creatures stood still, the wheels also stood still. And when the creatures rose from the ground, the wheels rose along with them, because the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Now, I've already mentioned north, south, east, and west as directions of these living creatures, but they can also go up and down, too, and the wheels just follow right along. Verse 22, spread out above the heads of the living creatures was what looked like an expanse, sparkling like ice and awesome. In other words, the sky. An expanse is like the big bright blue sky. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out one toward the other, and each one had two wings covering its body. We've already talked about the two flying wings being stretched out to touch the wings of their neighbor living creature. And then they also had two wings covering their body, maybe even two more wings. Of course, if you take that two wings covering its body, that would be in addition to the other four, and you end up with six. Two wings to fly, two wings to cover the chest, and two wings to cover the private parts. All the translations I looked at are ambiguous about that, so I'm not going to make a strong claim either way. Verse 24, when the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings, like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty, like the tumult of an army. When they stood still, they lowered their wings. So when they moved, there was this huge noise that went along with that. So not only was it a visual vision, this was a vision with sound effects. God's voice is often compared to the roar of rushing waters. If you ever listen to the waves break on the ocean like I have done every summer for the last 50 or so years, it does sound like somebody's roaring. It's a wonderful sound. I love it. Like the tumult of an army, that's what armies do when they fight. They make a lot of noise. Now, when the four living creatures stood still, they lowered their wings. Why? Well, to me, it's because they finished flying. They didn't need to uplift their wings anymore. But some people are a little more spiritual than me. They say that the four living creatures are ashamed of their own unworthiness and imperfection, and therefore they lower their wings. I don't believe that. I believe that lowering the wings denotes the living creatures having done their work, and they finished their course, so they don't need to fly anymore. We go now to Ezekiel 1, verses 25 through 28, and we will finish this chapter. Ezekiel continues, "Then there came a voice from above the expanse over their heads as they stood with lowered wings." The four living creatures stood with their wings lowered. They've stopped. "Above the expanse over their heads was what looked like a throne of sapphire, and high above on the throne was a figure like that of a man. I saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire, and that from there down he looked like fire, and brilliant light surrounded him. Like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day, so was the radiance around him. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking." So high up above, above the four living creatures in the sky, or the expanse, we see a sapphire throne. Sapphire, of course, is brilliant, bright blue rock, stone. It's very clear and transparent, very hard, solid, and durable, very precious and excellent, and azure sky color. Good symbolism there. The sapphire represented the clear manifestation of Christ's righteous judgments, the ministration of his kingly office, the duration of his government, the excellency of his rule, the heavenly nature of his rule. I go along with that symbolism. Now, at the end of verse 26, we see the figure was that of a man. Now, I don't know why I always took that to be God appearing in the form of a man, God the Father. No, this is Jesus. I've got six commentators that say it's Jesus: Gill, Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, Benson, Barnes, and Poole. And I don't like to do theology by the numbers, by democracy, but that's a lot of witnesses saying that's Jesus, and I think it is. Now, it doesn't say that sitting on the throne was a man. It was a figure like that of a man, because Jesus had not been incarnated yet, so he obviously was not a man yet, but he was like that of a man. In verse 27, Ezekiel saw that from what appeared to be his waist up, he looked like glowing metal, as if full of fire. Jesus was a consuming fire to his enemies. He was a fire and lightning to his people, a fire warming his people, a wall of fire protecting his people, a pillar of fire guiding and directing his people. Fire has a lot of good symbolism. In verse 27, from his waist up, he looked like he was glowing metal full of fire, and from his waist down, he looked like fire. He was fire all over, up and down. Brilliant light surrounded him. I imagine that's what Paul saw on the road to Damascus. Verse 28, like the appearance of a rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. Again, more bright light. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. When I saw it, I fell face down, and I heard the voice of one speaking. Now, that voice we're going to hear in the next chapter, which would be a good segue into the next chapter. But before we go there, in verse 28, we see that Jesus appears like a rainbow. Now, that rainbow has struck the imagination of Adam Clark. He says this, "Living creatures, wheels, fires, whirlwinds, which are introduced here, point out emblematically the various means, sword, fire, pestilence, famine, and their destruction, and that God appears in all this to show that Nebuchadnezzar is only his instrument to inflict all these calamities. What is in the following chapter appears to me to confirm this supposition." In other words, doom and gloom is coming on the bad guys, on the rebels of Judah. "But we have the rainbow," Clark continues, "the token of God's covenant to show that though there should be a destruction of the city, temple, yet there should not be a total ruin, after a long captivity, they should be restored. The rainbow is an illustrious token of mercy and love. Maybe so. Maybe that rainbow is not just to show how bright Jesus was, but also to show symbolically that there was going to be restoration after the judgment that fell on Judah. Now, there's no question all this talk of fire and lightning and voice like thunder, and it's got to be judgment. But usually when there's judgment in the Old Testament, there's redemption right behind it, forgiveness, restoration. I hope so. Well, the voice having spoken, we are now prepared to go to our next chapter in Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 2, which I will entitle Ezekiel's Call. Only 10 verses long. That'll be a short one. I hope you stay tuned for it, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.